first case, please.
Number 15, Anderson State Bar, Joel Curry, District Commitment, Elvin Gaines, Junior, for the Appellant, Arnold R. Attorney General, Peter R. Hammond, Senior, Attorney General of Chief, Christopher Warrington, and all of the Assistant Attorney General, Chief Helen.
You may proceed.
My name is Melvin Gavins. I'm here to represent Neil Kaczynski here today in this appeal from a public reprimand which was issued by the 3rd District Committee on November 16th of 2012. At this time, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal if possible. This is the second bar sanction stemming from Kaczynski's representation of Mr. Dylan Person in an estate case. Originally, Mr. Person sought help from Mr. Kaczynski in obtaining his share of Person's father's intestate estate. Person was indigent, and his case was very difficult. He had already signed a contract with his family saying that he wouldn't get any direct benefit from the estate, and he needed skilled representation. His sister was an attorney. This was a difficult case. He had no money. Kaczynski went out on a limb, and took the case. But it came a point where Mr. Person became a bit fractious, and they didn't always agree on things. So Mr. Kaczynski was afraid he wouldn't be paid. He took a quitclaim deed instead from Mr. Person for 25% of Person's interest in the property. Now, that was the subject matter of the first case, not this case, and he was issued a private admonition without terms on March 3rd of 2010 by the 3rd District Committee, which cited the violation of Rule 1.8J. Now, Kaczynski was represented in that matter by Mr. Michael Rigsby, who I'm sure the bar is familiar with. He's previously acted as bar counsel for many years. The bar claims that the case before the court today stems from Kaczynski's actions after the March 3rd, 2010 admonition without terms. But his representation contract and things that occurred before that are relevant to the understanding of the fact in this matter. So after Kaczynski took the quitclaim deed, he and Person had a falling out yet again, and Mr. Person fired Mr. Kaczynski. Because he was indigent, he was unable to find any other attorney to take his case, so he came back to Mr. Kaczynski and asked him to help him. And so Mr. Kaczynski entered into a second contract with Mr. Person. And this time, he fully disclosed that all of the contingency fee agreement in writing. He stated that in the contract that Mr. Kaczynski had earned the 25% interest represented by the quitclaim deed, and he gave Person the opportunity to seek outside counsel. It's right there in the contract. And Mr. Person signed that contract, and he waived any conflict of interest that was there regarding the quitclaim deed. There's been no allegation that the contingency fee was anything but fair and reasonable, and bar counsel has already conceded that Kaczynski did a considerable amount of work in return for his fee. When the 3rd District Committee issued the private admonition on March 2nd of 2010, the second contract was already in existence. The second contract referenced that 25% interest, as I said before, and there was no terms in the admonition. So even though that contract existed, there was no mention of that in the first case. He was not told to divest himself of the interest, and although he obtained the interest in violation of 1.8J, there was nothing in the rule to indicate that he needed to divest it. In fact, the second contract complied with the requirements of Rule 1.8A, which is, ironically, one of the rules that he is now charged with violating. In its written determination, the 3rd District Committee gave 6 reasons why Kaczynski violated the rules. But upon careful examination, all of these reasons can really be reduced to 2 things. First, he contributed to continue to maintain the interest originally represented by the quitclaim deed. And second, when Person told him that he would not be paid, basically firing him, Kaczynski sued Person for fees and filed a partition suit to liquidate the 25% interest. All of the facts cited by the Third District Committee really lead back to these two underlying facts. He didn't divest the interest, and he sought to liquidate that interest in order to be paid. Kaczynski is accused of violating three rules of conduct. Of course, the first one is 1.8a, as we've discussed. And although Kaczynski took great pains to comply with that rule, the bar seeks to resurrect the issue as if somehow it relates to events after the March 3rd admonition. But actually, that contract took place before the March 3rd admonition. The plain wording of the rule speaks of the acquisition of an interest adverse to the clients, not maintenance of such an interest once obtained. But furthermore, the way in which Kaczynski drafted the second contract not only complies with 1.8a, but it furthers Virginia's public policy, which regards access to the courts by indigent persons. And the person got his fair share of his father's estate only because Kaczynski was willing to fight for him when nobody else was willing to fight. In a very difficult case, he prevailed. Now, the preamble to the rule states that a lawyer should be mindful of the deficiencies in the administration of justice, and we see that all too often. And the preamble goes on to tell us that we should look out for the poor, basically, something that I think that Chief Justice mentioned earlier today when she swore in members of the bar, that we should look out for people that need our services, no matter what. It's important to all of us. And so what Kaczynski actually did was he helped someone who couldn't have gotten help any other way, and now he's being sanctioned for it. Comment 16 to the Rule 1.8J recognizes the policy in its reference to the exceptions, and it talks about how the original rules of champerty and maintenance of the common law are really the origin of that exception. The exception is carved out in 1.8a, it seems, as well as it's the origin of where we get the whole notion of contingency fees as being a proper way to proceed in Virginia in the right cases. When Kaczynski accepted the private admonition without terms, he did so without demanding a trial on the matter, believing he'd already corrected the violation of Rule 1.8j for obtaining the quitclaim deed, and that he felt like he complied with 1.8a when he renewed the contract. So nobody told him otherwise, not the bar, not his experienced bar counsel, former bar counsel attorney, Mr. Rigsby.
Counsel, if I understand the holding with regard to 1.8a, one of the actions on Mr. Kaczynski's part that the bar found that violated that particular section was his continued ownership of this property and the filing of the partition suit pursuant to the, not the quitclaim deed, but the special commissioner's deed that he received. Are you asserting that those actions do not violate the rule?
Under these circumstances, I am asserting that, yes, ma'am. Partly, Your Honor, because we disagree with whether or not he still represented Mr. Person at the time that he filed the partition suit. Mr. Person had turned to him in the courtroom and said, "I ain't paying you nothing." That's a direct quote. Now, anybody that is told that gets the idea that they're not to do any further work, it would seem, and anyone who says that pretty much knows they're releasing that person from any further work.
But he did obtain the special commissioner's deed to specific property, because the quitclaim deed was not to specific property. He was still representing him at that time, wasn't he?
Yes, Your Honor. That was at that point, but he objected to that. He didn't want that. If you look, the situation was that he asked instead to be given a deed of trust. He had said all along, and he believed that in the first case that the bar believed him. He didn't really want an interest in the property. What he really wanted to do was just simply secure his fee. He expected to be like a springing lien in case he needed to use it later on in order to collect his fee. So it wasn't like he wanted an adverse interest at the time. He was instead trying to secure it. And so he asked instead for a deed of trust, which would have been a better way to do it, probably.
Well, he certainly could have conveyed his interest to his client if that's what he wanted in exchange for the deed of trust.
Well, he attempted to do that. And in fact, he had already set that up. He had a general warranty deed written to written by Mr. Person's other attorney, was ready to turn that over. But then there was an argument with Mr. Person as to how that would go, and so it took a while before that ultimately did happen. He did trade
Well, that was after the partition suit was filed, right?
I'm sorry.
That was after the partition suit was filed.
Right, it was. It was. But it was what he wanted all along. He's trying to do that. He simply couldn't get Mr. Person to go along with it. He was from, during that same month, I think at the beginning of the month, about the 3rd when he was sanctioned, around the 27th is when they went to court on this. He was trying at that point. He asked at that point for a deed of trust instead. And Judge Gates said, no, that's something you need to work out with your client. I'm not going to get involved in it. And he ordered Commissioner Bain to write the deed to Mr. Kaczynski. Mr. Kaczynski objected to that. But what are you going to do? The judge says you can't do it that way. So he obeyed that. And again, remember that at that point, he believed that he had acquired it properly, because he had gone through the steps in, that you see in 1.8A. Of course, he's also charged with a violation.
Counsel, before you go into that, can I ask you a question? I'm a little bit concerned about your understanding of the termination of representation. Your position is that when somebody tells you in court they're not going to pay you, that terminates your representation? Don't we have formal requirements of asking the court to allow you to withdraw or to have a formal termination with your client?
Well, the case was actually over in all respects. I'm very dry, excuse me. Over in all respects other than simply signing that final order with the objections that he'd made there in court.
Well, that's a significant step, is it not?
It's ministerial. He's already made the objection. All he had to do was sign the paper. He didn't prepare the order. The order was prepared by another attorney. And so, really, there was very little left to be done. It was all ministerial. Perhaps, and we're not even sure, that record isn't clear on it, perhaps there were some checks that needed to be distributed when it came in. But the only thing that was left, really, was the final order. And here, the man turns to him and says, basically, I'm not going to pay you. I think that means you're fired. I see that.
So does that mean you're not going to do those things? Does that mean you're fired? So I can't sign the order. I'm fired. I'm not his lawyer anymore, and
no,
I can't distribute checks. And I don't want people to send checks to me because I don't work for the guy.
No, you have a duty at that point, just like you have to.
Because you're still represented.
To any former client, sir. Any former client you represent, you have still have that.
You have a duty to a former client?
You do, Judge.
To do what?
To distribute, if a check comes into you that belongs to that former client, you certainly can't keep it. You need to give it to your former client. It's the proper thing to do.
Well, I guess you do that to anybody, though.
Well,
not because they're your former client, because the money's not yours.
That's correct. I see my time is almost up here. I'd like to reserve some for the public.
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Christy Manolo, and I represent the appellee, the Virginia State Bar. This case is about attorneys' overzealous attempt to collect fees from a client by filing two separate suits against his client while he still represented him. Mr. Kaczynski received a private admonition because his fee agreement with Mr. Person violated the rules because it gave him an interest in litigation. Instead of doing what he should have done, rescind the quick claim deed he received through the fee agreement, he used the court system to secure a greater interest in his client's property.
On that point, you're saying he should have rescinded the quitclaim deed, but that was not. There were no terms on the first violation. If he had actually, it sounds like then, if he had rescinded the quitclaim deed, we wouldn't be here today. Is that right?
That is correct. If he had rescinded the quitclaim deed and had not taken any of these, he did take additional actions as far as suing Mr. Pearson in general district court, taking a default judgment and docketing a lien while before a final order was entered in the matter that
But the partition suit
could not have been filed.
Right. So I'm a little concerned about how the state bar takes the position he should have rescinded the quitclaim deed when there were no terms on the first violation.
Well, the first violation was because he took an interest in litigation. That interest was the quitclaim interest and property in that litigation. There were no terms. But when he received that private admonition, it certainly informed him that the fee agreement, the quitclaim deed, was a violation of the rules. At that point in time, an attorney knows not to pursue that interest. That's an ethical violation. So while there were no terms, certainly being informed that your fee agreement, the quitclaim deed, violates the rules, informs you that you cannot pursue to collect fees through that manner. Mr. As we were saying, Mr. Kuchinski sued Mr. Pearson twice before a final order was entered. First, he filed a partition lawsuit to force the sale of the property against his client's will. Next, he requested a default judgment against his client and docketed the default judgment against his client's interest in the property on the same day. Both of these occurred, again, before a final order was entered in the estate matter on which he represented Mr. Pearson.
Doesn't that conduct violate another rule rather than Rule 1.8?
It violates one. He was only charged with 1.8A and 3.4 and 8.4.
That's what I'm asking. Does that conduct of filing the suits before the representation had ended actually violate Rule 1.8? I know it's listed as part of the conduct that the district committee found in violation of that rule, but I'm asking you, is it your position that that action specifically violates 1.8? It probably violates another rule. I forget the number. But I wonder, because 1.8 is not entering into a business relationship or transaction.
Well, 1.8 also talks about acquiring adverse interest against your client as well. Certainly when he took a default judgment against his client and docketed that against his client's property, then that was an adverse interest against his client. The partition suit also was adverse to his client. When the March 30th deed was issued by the special commissioner, at that point there was a business. The two of them were in the business of owning these two properties together. The records reflect their issues regarding taxes and issues regarding the maintenance of the property. It's also that deed which allowed him to file the partition suit while he still represented his client. All of these things go to a business transaction and acquiring adverse interest to his client while he still represented his client. It may well violate another rule that he was not charged with, but it does also fit this rule.
And what significance, if any, does the contract that he entered into excuse me, with his client after the first admonition with regard to his holding the quitclaim deed? What role does that play in whether he violated Rule 1.8?
The second agreement really does not play any role in this case. The second agreement that was entered, I believe, November 8, 2008, simply says he's already earned that 25% quitclaim interest and he waives conflict of interest. It does not go to the actions that occurred March 30th on. It also, certainly, if you look at the requirements of Rule 1.8a, in order to have a client agree to the waiver of the conflict of interest, it says it must be fully disclosed. When you look at the second fee agreement, there is no full disclosure. Again, it simply says he's already earned this quitclaim interest and he waives a conflict of interest. It does not disclose what this means, what this is going to entail, what effect this is going to have on Mr. Pearson. So it's our position that the second agreement, while it has no bearing on the actions that occurred March 30th, 2010 on, that are what this bar appeal are about, even if you want to look at it, it doesn't fulfill the disclosure requirements of Rule 1.8a for full disclosure to the client in writing. As to the objection in the commissioner's report that Mr. Kuchinski refers to, that was filed January of 2010, again, that just he wants a deed of trust as opposed to the special commissioner's deed. It does not try to fix the problem. It does not object that this quitclaim interest was in violation of the rules. And so it does not help with what happened March 30th, 2010 on. All the actions that he took March 30th, 2010 on, he did seek to acquire greater interest, did acquire a greater interest, sought to force the sale of the property against his client's will, docketed a lien against the property, unbeknownst to his client because it was a default judgment. The objections in the commissioner's report do not go to any of those actions that occurred March 30th, 2010 on. As to the Rule 3-4 violation, this addresses the issue with regard to the private admonition that he received. Again, he received a private admonition because his fee agreement, which gave him a 25% quitclaim interest in the property that his client would receive in the estate matter, violated Rule 18J, which prevents taking an interest in litigation.
Is it the bar's position when you get a private admonition like that, it's basically a direction to divest yourself of something you've done wrong?
I believe it's a direction to not continue to do it, and if there is some corrective measure that you need to take, then you should take that. Otherwise, the admonition has no real effect.
Wouldn't it be helpful to put that in the language of the admonition?
It would be helpful. However, the way the rules are written, a subcommittee, which is what the private admonition came out of, does not actually, they're allowed to issue a private admonition, but not one with terms. So the subcommittee did what it could here in issuing the private admonition. In order for there to be terms, there would have had to have been an agreed disposition, which there was not here. Or it would have had to have been sent to the board or to the district committee.
You don't think you could direct them to do something without that being a term? I guess that would be awkward. Okay, I understand your position.
Well, actually, what the district committee says on that point is that that he violated the rule by, quote, not divesting himself of his ownership interest until 1 year after he received person's complaint to the Virginia State Bar. So that's the answer to Justice Millett's question, isn't it? I mean, the State Bar, the committee said specifically he violated the rule by not divesting himself of his ownership interest.
Right, the district committee on the 3.4 violation.
Right.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
But divesting himself of that interest was not a term, was it?
It was not a term. There were no terms. The subcommittees, again, their options were...
So why wouldn't it be a new violation as opposed to him, disobeying a standing rule or ruling? Why wouldn't it just be a new violation?
A new 18J violation?
Yeah.
I suppose that could be another way to charge it. I
guess I just have difficulty seeing that somebody disregarded a standing rule or ruling when the standing rule or ruling had no term that they were supposed to adhere to.
Well, the standing ruling was that this fee agreement,
what he did in the past was wrong,
violated the rules. I believe that what you then do is you take that and you don't continue to pursue that interest. You have
well,
been
let
told.
Me ask you this. What if he had terminated his relationship with the party? Would we still be here today if he no longer represented this particular individual when he sought to petition the property, when he sought to sue the person for attorney's fees that they owed him? Would he still be violating the admonition that you all had given him before?
I do believe he would still be violating the admonition. The fact that the relationship continued goes to the 18A violation. The 3.4 violation deals with the fact that he had been told that this fee agreement was in violation of the ethical rules.
Right, and he'd been punished for it.
He'd received a private admonition. So then he just continued to keep on with the same actions. He stayed the same course, even though he knew that fee agreement
was
violated.
When you say stay the same course, he didn't get another 25% interest, and he didn't get another quick claim deed. He wasn't getting quick claim deeds every week or something from the guy.
He did not get another quick claim deed, but he did take the interest that he had. Then on March 30th, it became a greater interest. It went from just being a quitclaim interest to an actual ownership interest in two pieces of property with his clients.
Well, I'm not sure you answered Justice Goodwin's first question that I'm very interested in. After the private admonition, which did not specifically tell him, divest yourself of this quitclaim deed, are you saying that if he had terminated his relationship with Mr. Person and had never thereafter represented him, but he had continued to hold the quitclaim deed and had done nothing more than that to this very day, that he would be subject to a charge under this particular 3.4?
Well, if he had continued to hold the interest and done nothing more, we wouldn't be here. I think the problem comes in.
Well,
I
want to know the bar's position, whether you think that's a violation of Rule 3, but whether you would have opted to charge him or not. I'd like to know if you consider that a violation of 3.4.
I think he violated Rule 3.4 when he not only continued.
No. That's not my question. My question is just if I gave you, if he'd done nothing else, had ended the relationship and had done nothing else, but had continued to hold the quitclaim deed in light of the private admonition, is it the bar's position that that conduct would violate 3.4? Is this a simple yes or no?
I do believe that that could be a violation of 3.4, because while there were not terms, again, he was instructed that that was an ethical violation to have that interest. If he continues to hold that interest, then he hasn't done anything in response or to fix that ethical violation.
But it's only an ethical violation because he's representing the man. And the premise of the question is he's no longer representing the man. I'm not sure you understand the question.
The issue is how he received that quitclaim interest. He received that quitclaim interest in violation of the rules. As far as the quitclaim deed is concerned, that is what is important.
And he received a private admonition because of that.
Correct.
So now you remove the basis for the unethical conduct by terminating the relationship. What's the violation now?
Well, I believe that if he were to go back and to enter into another agreement with Mr. Pearson after the relationship is over for a quitclaim interest, that's a different story. But once you receive an interest in violation of the rules, you cannot just continue to hold that interest.
So you're saying that disgorgement is an automatic requirement once one is found to be in violation of the rule?
I believe that that would be a reasonable interpretation by most attorneys, that if you're told that something you're doing violates
the rules. Well, you did. Not something you're doing, but something you did.
Correct. Something you did violates the rules.
And you're punished for it.
Right.
You don't do it anymore when you end the relationship.
But what we have here is not just.
I know that's not this case, but we're trying to, when we have cases, we have to think about, you know, how our decisions impact other situations.
Right.
I think you've answered my question. Your time's expired. Thank you.
Thank you. And we would ask that you would affirm the violations.
Rebuttal.
The first thing I'd like to clear up is this was an agreed upon order. Mr. Kaczynski did not ask for a trial. They sent him the order, he signed it, and sent it back. It was an agreed-upon order.
We know that.
And they could have admonished him beyond just the simple admonishment. The court speaks only through its orders. We're all conditioned to think that way. It's a very basic law. There was no order that says you've got to disgorge this. He knew he violated J, but he thought since he followed A under 1.8 that he'd fix things. And it had happened before the admonition. Remember, the second contract.
You make a big point about that. Are you saying that the bar should look back and make sure that there's nothing else that's happened between the time they charge him and the time they actually do the admonition? Do you get like a free pass for anything that happens in between?
I wouldn't call it a free pass, but I would say that there's a very good chance that their investigator would be able to find out what's going on with that. And in fact, their investigator was baffled by what the charge was. He had to ask the bar himself If you look at the record in his testimony, he and Mr. Rigsby and Mr. Kaczynski were all baffled as to what was the difference between the first and the second bar complaint. They couldn't figure that out. You know, the second contract was prior to the admonition, and so Mr. Kaczynski's thinking, well, you know, the quitclaim deed was wrong, so I fixed that. They didn't tell me to get rid of it, so even if they didn't know about it, I think that it's reasonable for Mr. Kaczynski to think that they may have. And I think it's reasonable for Mr. Kaczynski to think, well, I fixed it. I've done what I'm supposed to do. I acquired it improperly. Okay, I took my lumps for that. I admitted it. I didn't go to trial on that. But I fixed it as well. And so if you look at all the reasons that that we have here for all of the different rules, they give the six reasons, two for each one of them, and most of them don't even fit the rules. There is nothing in 1.8a that deals with an attorney versus a client. Justice Kinzer mentioned that and mentioned that there may be another rule, and I agree, but my time is up. And I thank you, and I ask you to reverse this. Thank you.
Thank you. Call the next case, please.